Utukkanavut Irniri Ravut. Our ancestors are our fire.
This year's Elders and Youth Conference kicks off in Anchorage. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, October 15th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, ConocoPhillips Alaska's president says a wave of oil production is coming to the North Slope.
We believe there's the opportunities for hundreds of thousands of barrels of incremental production to come on over the next, let's say, 5 to 10 years.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
Candidate Elise Galvin would seem to be on a roll. Two recent polls have shown her within 4 percentage points of Alaska Congressman Don Young. And today, the Democratic nominee reports she's raised nearly $1.2 million in contributions, more than the Republican incumbent has raised. But Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin says other signs aren't so positive for the challenger.
The Galvin campaign always seems to have new union endorsements to announce. She has the National Education Association on her side and the American Federation of Teachers, which includes the Alaska Public Employees Association. That might be expected. Teachers and public employees unions lean Democratic. And Galvin made a name for herself pressing the legislature for more money for schools. But Galvin also has endorsements from a couple of the building trade unions, the IBEW, that's the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades. The business rep for the Painters Local 1959, Bronson Fry, says the union likes her support for apprenticeships. But Fry says the endorsement shouldn't be viewed as a statement against Young.
To be clear, he has been good for organized labor, particularly the building trades, for a long time. We just felt that Ms. Galvin had a vision that really appealed to us.
The Painters is a relatively small union, representing a few hundred Alaska workers. The IBEW Local 1547 has nearly 5,000 members. Its leaders declined to discuss its endorsement of Galvin. But the powerful Teamsters Local 959 is even larger. And the Teamsters endorsed Young. As for the polls showing Galvin is right behind Young, online election forecasters have looked at them, but they still say Young is likely, or very likely, to win the race. The statisticians at 538.com say Galvin has at best a 30% chance of winning. The publication Inside Elections foresees the race as a solid win for the Republican. And Larry Sabato, who edits the Larry Sabato's Crystal Ball newsletter at the University of Virginia, has Young as a likely win. But he warns he might push the race to a more competitive category before Election Day, now just 3 weeks away. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
In a speech today in Anchorage, ConocoPhillips Alaska President Joe Marushak said the company is looking at the potential for oil development in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. But Conoco's main focus is farther west in the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska, or NPRA, where the company is pursuing a series of major projects. Last week, the company announced the first oil production from a drill site in NPRA called Greater Moose's Tooth 1. This month, Conoco is also likely to get a key federal approval for another oil development in NPRA called Greater Moose's Tooth 2. And the company is laying plans for a much bigger oil development nearby called the Willow Project. In his speech, Marushak called these projects part of a new wave of oil production in Alaska, something he called a North Slope Renaissance. Elizabeth Harbaugh of Alaska's Energy Desk caught up with Marushak in the hallway after his speech and asked him what a North Slope Renaissance could mean for the state.
We believe there's the opportunities for hundreds of thousands of barrels of incremental production to come on over the next, let's say, 5 to 10 years. Now, it doesn't all come on all at the same time. It kind of gets feathered in different things. But we still believe there's the opportunity for hundreds of thousands of barrels of incremental production over this time period.
So a couple years ago when I got here, there was real concern about the future of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline and low flow. Does this mean that that is not a concern anymore?
Well, we have to maintain a stable fiscal environment, and we've got to make sure that the regulations are in place that allows us to develop these and get permits on a timely fashion. But yeah, I think that if those two things are maintained, we've got to be able to weather these cycles, these up and down cycles in oil. We still have to worry about low flow at some point in time, but I think if we can get some of these things, these projects moving forward, that'll go a long way to solving that problem for a long time.
A lot of these developments are happening in a region where there's lots of wildlife, there's a community that Nuiqsut cares very deeply about subsistence. So as these developments move forward, can Conoco make sure the impacts don't add up in a negative way?
We do that, yes. We obviously, there's a lot of consultation that goes through. We try to operate in a environmentally very sensitive fashion. We do lots and lots of studies on fish and wildlife, and we share that with folks. So yeah, we believe that these developments can happen in an environmentally sensitive way, and it's really important to us that we do that. It's just good business for us to do that, too.
So oil prices are up around $80. What does that mean for everything Conoco has planned, and does it mean you might be able to hire more Alaskans?
So these developments that we're doing, especially with the Willow Project, will mean lots of opportunity for Alaskans. And it's extremely important to me that we do look carefully. ConocoPhillips does look carefully at what Alaskans can do and what they can participate in. We'll be working, obviously, with the unions in order to develop these opportunities. We need a lot of labor on them.
On the oil price, though, I think I was hearing you say you don't think that $80 a barrel oil is here to stay necessarily. Why is that?
So we are not good at predicting oil prices. So what we've decided we need to do is we need to make sure we've got our costs that are maintained at a low enough fashion that we can weather these cycles. And we believe there will be cycles. There's $80 now. We didn't necessarily see that coming. We certainly didn't see a $28 oil coming in 2015. But we've got ourselves in a position where we think we can be competitive as we go through these cycles over time.
I think I heard you mention up there, and this is a good question to clarify, that you saw ANWR as a potential opportunity. What did you mean by that? Are we going to expect Conoco to show up at a lease sale if the feds hold one?
Well, we're looking at it. I can't tell you for sure yet because we're looking at it. But just like all opportunities, we look and see if it makes sense for us to be there or not, and we'll look at this one too.
That was Elizabeth Harbaugh of Alaska's Energy Desk talking to ConocoPhillips Alaska President Joe Marushak. Day one of Elders and Youth has wrapped up in Anchorage today. The annual conference precedes the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention each fall, designed to strengthen intergenerational connections and share Indigenous knowledge around the state. In front of a crowded ballroom in the downtown Denaina Center, Patuk Glenn gave an introduction to this year's theme in Inupiaq and English.
Otukkanavut Erniri Ravut. Ancestors are our fire.
The elder keynote address came from Ugiaktuk Wesley Eichen, who at age 92 was introduced as the oldest man in Utqiagvik, a whaler, reindeer herder, tradesman, and community leader throughout his life. Eichen told young members of the audience to seek out what the tools would be that would best equip them to support themselves in modern life. In his time, that meant hunting and learning whatever trades he could in his community.
I wish I had higher education myself, but I try to make a living what I can do in my hometown. I'm a carpenter, I'm a mechanic, heavy equipment operator.
Generally, Elders and Youth is an less overtly political event than AFN, but this year state politics looms large. A group that formed last year, Native Peoples Action, presented on efforts to mobilize Indigenous votes in the upcoming November elections. During a panel on Alaska Natives entering state government, Juliana Clock told the crowd she'd been able to channel anger over racial disparities she saw growing up in Caltag into action, working as an analyst for the governor's office.
The knowledge we gain from the people who lift us up, from our parents and our grandparents, our elders and our ancestors, is just as valuable as the Western certificates that we gain in schools. And it's important to get those too. We are equal to all the people in, in those rooms. And we have a place at the table. And we have a voice.
Though far from a campaign stump speech, Governor Bill Walker's address touched on several recent events. Walker noted how much he's learned about Indigenous languages since coming into office, but says signing a recent administrative order on the issue was overshadowed by the funeral in Kotzebue for 10-year-old Ashley Johnson Barr just a day before.
I celebrate all the great things that happened in Alaska while I'm governor. But I take full responsibility for everything that's bad that happens in Alaska because I'm governor. And I take that very seriously. And so as I sat through that service, the 2.5 hours in Kotzebue, all I could think of was, what could I have done differently? What could I have done as governor to make sure that hadn't happened? Make sure that never happens again.
Walker is in a tough three-way race for re-election where recent polling has Republican candidate Mike Dunleavy at a significant advantage. The Elders and Youth Conference wraps up on Wednesday. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Seldovia woman improvises with a broom to defend her home against a bear.
He jumped up on that window and he was so fat he could not get through the window. And I hauled off and gave that broom everything I had.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
The legalization of marijuana in Canada beginning next Wednesday will create a block of pot-legal states and provinces from California to Alaska. But it will still be illegal to cross the U.S.-Canada border with cannabis. The Canadian Consul General in Seattle, Brandon Lee, says he's concerned travelers might forget.
Both Canada and the U.S. have very strict penalties for possession of marijuana as you cross the border.
And those will not change. One difference between Canadian and American marijuana laws is that the minimum age for purchase and possession of marijuana will be 19 in British Columbia versus 21 years old in the United States. Public safety is a leading concern across Alaska, and in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, it has been voted the region's top issue by delegates attending the Association of Village Council Presidents annual convention. After the convention adjourned last week, Alaska's three gubernatorial campaigns presented their solutions on the topic. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
The three campaigns have very different ideas about public safety. Deborah Call is Democratic candidate Mark Begich's running mate. To improve public safety, Call proposes cross-training urban and rural law enforcement throughout the state. Call envisions rural village public safety officers and troopers shadowing urban police officers to get a better understanding of urban challenges, to find new mentors, and to learn new technology.
Because I think what happens in public safety and law enforcement, sometimes I think there's silos effect. And that certainly happens, I think, with the VPSOs. But then also do the reverse. Take our urban law enforcement officers and have them spend some time in the villages and understand what our VPSOs and our communities are dealing with.
John Mueller is the campaign co-chair for Republican candidate Mike Dunleavy. Mueller traveled to Bethel with Dunleavy's wife, Rose Dunleavy. Mueller served as the rural affairs advisor for Republican Governor Sean Parnell, and Mueller says that Dunleavy wants to pull together a public safety team with many of the key players that serve Parnell.
We built probably one of the most robust VPSO programs and trooper programs in the history of the state. And Mike Dunleavy wants to put the team together again to redo that.
Incumbent candidate Governor Bill Walker suggests using a familiar model in a new way. Walker wants to compact with Alaska tribes to work on public safety and education, just as the state has compacted with tribes to create health organizations like the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation.
If we can do working with the tribes on education, public safety, what the tribes have done with public health, oh my, we will have the safest Alaska and the best education system, what I've seen happening with public health.
Walker has also proposed a pay increase for village public safety officers to match a recent pay increase to state troopers. And the incumbent governor proposes creating an investigation and deployment unit with aircraft and other resources to more quickly reach rural communities. He also wants to increase rural emergency preparedness by expanding the Alaska State Defense Force. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
The Alaska Board of Fisheries started an annual work session in Anchorage today, and salmon hatcheries will be a prominent topic of discussion. The board will consider whether to add issues surrounding production levels to future agendas, and it will kick off a broader discussion on the hatchery industry tomorrow. KBBI's Aaron Bolton reports.
Disagreements over salmon hatcheries have been roiling over the past few years, and those arguments have played out at Board of Fish meetings. Hatchery opponents want the Alaska Department of Fish and Game to conduct more studies on the effects of hatchery fish that spawn with wild populations, and to start examining potential ocean carrying capacity issues. The department is currently in the midst of a large hatchery wild spawning study. Hatchery operators point to that as an example of due diligence by the department. Operators like Cook Inlet Aquaculture Executive Director Gary Fondery say they're ready for the board's broad discussion on the state of hatcheries Tuesday, which may touch on some of those issues.
We're prepared for it. The hatchery programs are based on good, sound science, and we follow those principles. They're well regulated by the Department of Fish and Game, and we believe that we are above board with everything that we're doing.
An emergency petition back in March sparked the board's discussion. The petition asked the board to look into Prince William Sound pinks that have been straying into Lower Cook Inlet streams. Valdez Fisheries Development Association Executive Director Mike Wells thinks the discussion will help the public better understand how hatcheries operate.
I think that the hatchery community will be there and ready to provide comment, certainly to correct any misunderstandings or miscommunications of areas with regard to our program.
Others are hoping those conversations will lead to change. Ricky Geese is the executive director of the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association, and he acknowledges the department is studying hatchery-wild interactions in freshwater. However, he says a recent Fish and Game report reviewing the state's hatchery policies shows the department's reluctance to study interactions in the open ocean. He hopes the board will take up that issue in its discussions.
What few people realize is that we have more salmon in the ocean than ever before, yet over the last decade, the average size of salmon have actually been decreasing. What is driving that? We have record numbers, but we're, driving the average size down.
Geese also says recent king and sockeye run failures are evidence that large numbers of hatchery fish, namely pink salmon, are increasing competition in the Gulf of Alaska. Fish and Game's report says those issues could be the result of many environmental factors. While it's unclear what direction the board's broader discussion may go, members will also consider two agenda change requests surrounding hatchery production, specifically the harvesting of eggs. Geese's organization submitted one of those requests, which mirrors an emergency petition it submitted earlier this year, asking the board to prevent the Valdez Fisheries Development Association from increasing its egg take by 20 million at its Solomon Gulch hatchery.
So the board decided that it wasn't an emergency situation, but that doesn't mean that the situation isn't important. And this is the next available opportunity outside of an emergency request to try and get the issue on the agenda of the Board of Fisheries.
It's unknown whether the board will put the item on a future agenda, as the eggs have already been collected and hatched. Another proposal is also asking the board to set a statewide cap on hatchery production. I'm Aaron Bolton, reporting in Homer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
A Seldovia woman fought off a black bear inside of her home with nothing more than a broom early Monday morning. Karen Mahan says she was working on her computer shortly before 2 a.m. when she heard a noise coming from her living room and kitchen. Mahan assumed it was her two teenage boys when she went to check, but to her surprise, a black bear had broken through her front door and was in her entryway.
It had to have been over 200 pounds. He was a big bear. He was looking at me.
and I run in my bedroom to grab my gun. I get my gun. I don't realize that my ammo is old. As I'm walking out my bedroom door in a hurry, he's already in the living room, standing between my couch and my rifle cabinet. And he starts peeling his lips back and growling at me, and I pull my gun on him to shoot him, and it dry fires.
Mahan says after her pistol failed to fire a second time, she grabbed a metal broom nearby and began hitting the bear, pushing it back toward the entryway.
I hit him, and he was growling, spitting, clicking his teeth at me. I shoved him back onto the porch. He jumped up on that window, and he was so fat he could not get through the window. And I hauled off and gave that broom everything I had, and I shoved him out that two-story window. He hit my son's truck and dented the door, and then making all sorts of noise and took off running.
Mahan says the bear mostly just spread trash around her entryway and that there was minimal damage to her home. Saldovia Police Chief Paul Cushman responded to the scene after Mahan called to report the incident. Cushman says he patrolled the area for the bear but was unable to locate the animal. Cushman says if the bear is located, he plans to trap and relocate it. The incident follows several reports of a nuisance bear around town. Cushman assumes it is the same bear, but says it's possible there may be two bears in town causing mischief. He encourages residents in the area to be aware of their surroundings and to keep trash out of reach. NEX's runway construction project has seen its fair share of critics, but that criticism has ramped up after the state installed a new airport beacon that will help guide pilots when they land. KYUK's Christy Schallenberger brings us this report from NEX.
There are many things that could keep people up at night, but for some NEX residents...
You're talking about the FAA beacon.
Yeah.
Yeah, the one that wakes up... Everybody in their town when they're trying to sleep?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I haven't got my rifle sighted on it yet, but might one day. But, yeah, it's directly right on my house.
Dave Mattson owns an automotive shop and, for obvious reasons, doesn't like the new airport beacon. He lives close to Vince Winter, another resident who is also upset about the new beacon. Winter showed me where the beacon shines into his house when I visited Antioch 2 weeks ago. So where are we heading to?
This is the living room. You can see the large window here.
Winter lives on the second floor of his house. That means the beacon shines right into the windows of his living room and his bedroom.
And on this floor, on this side of the runway, there's no obstructions. I have my living room and two bedrooms that this light, once it turns dark, comes on, and you actually basically need sunscreen in here because that's how bright the light is.
The old airport beacon used to be farther down the road. It was taller. And then, 2 months ago, the new beacon just appeared without any notification to residents. It's part of a big and expensive runway construction project that ANIAC must do to meet federal aviation requirements. And the solution to the beacon is complicated. Mattson says some people are trying to put together a petition to complain, but...
I don't know if anybody knows where to submit it to.
Meanwhile, ANIAC's city manager has tried to come up with a solution with Kinnick Construction, which is in charge of the runway project. City manager Kevin Toothaker says it's too expensive to move the beacon, and moving it would just mean the beacon shines into other homes. Other suggestions include some kind of shield to soften the light or change the light's angle. But so far...
I'm more kind of mellow about it all because, you can't have... My father used to tell me, you can't have pizza every day. Sometimes you got to eat Brussels sprouts, and that's kind of one of those things there. Something you just kind of got to make friends with.
He says that the beacon could guide people out on snow machines back to ANIAC. For now, Toothaker says he will bring up the concerns about the beacon with Kinnick Construction again. Reporting in Bethel and ANIAC, I'm Christy Schallenberger.
Petersburg School District is looking at starting a new sport at the high school, esports. It's video gaming, and as KFSK's Angela Denning reports, it's one of the fastest growing team-based competitions for youth in the state.
Back again, going for the play. Can he get himself any suppressed? The first damage. Ah!
Over 40 million people watched this video game playing out on their screens last year. It was the World Championships of League of Legends.
Simply, there was no fight to be had for SKT.
Okay. So that was a very smart play.
Jack Beyer is a junior at Petersburg High School. He's giving a presentation to the school board on what esports is and why his club wants to start a team by next spring. He says they will eventually be able to compete against other schools.
It's just a sport. It's a team-based competition, much like basketball or football, but it just includes video games instead.
Beyer acts as the club's coach right now. He says in competition, teams use the skill sets of individual players to overcome the opposing team.
It's kind of like a game of chess. You outsmart your opponent so you can take all of their pieces until they fall. Except with esports, the decisions that can win games are not made in minutes, but in seconds and milliseconds.
Over 30 schools in the state have esports teams starting up this fall. Alaska has followed Connecticut as the second state to join a national gaming program, Electronic Gaming Federation. The program supports three video games in a controlled setting: League of Legends, which is a battle arena video game; Rocket League, a soccer video game that also involves racing vehicles; and Overwatch, a shooter game. There is shooting, fighting, and destroying other characters in the games, but they are rated age appropriate. The high school competitions would be online, so little travel is needed, but Petersburg High School principal Rick Dormer says the players will still be held to the same academic requirements and drug policies as other sports.
They're a team, and they really will be Petersburg Vikings competing, which means something here. You know, you're part of the community, you are representing, and just because you're not, you know, jumping and slamming a basketball, you are competing against other schools, and that self-pride, and a lot of scientific studies show that that is a higher connectedness in school, and kids always do better in school when they're more connected.
Most of the games require at least 5 players. In Petersburg, the students meet every weekday from 3 to 5 p.m. in the school's technology room.
And they thought first I lost my mind because we've been saying no gaming on the school-issued laptops.
That's the district's technology director, John Kluepainter. He supports esports, even though he also encourages limiting screen time. Last year, he helped bring the film Screenagers to town, which highlights the negative impacts of too much screen time on youth. Kluepainter says he understands the mixed message, but he says esports gives gamers who otherwise might be playing alone an opportunity to come together.
These kids are gaming already. They're doing this at home and in their free time. Giving them an environment to do it that's organized and safe, I think, is really one of the strong points to this.
Petersburg's activities director, Jamie Cabral, says although it hasn't happened yet, the Alaska School Activities Association will be accepting esports as a sanctioned sport soon. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Elizabeth Harbaugh and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Christy Schallenberger in Aniak, Aaron Bolton in Homer, Angela Denning in Petersburg, and Tom Bonsi in Oregon. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.